Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a Toronto episode to recall the highs and the lows, but hopefully more of the highs. I'm happy to be talking with Eric Hines, who's also fresh from another festival.
Hello, Nick. Great to be back. Great to be with you. I'm just back from the Camden International Film Festival, Camden and Rockland, Maine Documentary Festival, which I do really love, and they have great programming. And so I'm back from that and actually saw a few of the films that we're going to talk about today in Maine. You know, had an opportunity to catch up to some things there.
I can't resist just mentioning, since it was pretty surprising that there was a hurricane. That was one unexpected challenge of the festival.
Yeah, I think the first time in the 19-year history of the festival they had like significant weather, because apparently hurricanes really don't make their way up there. Somebody told me the last time there was a significant hurricane was in the 1930s. So, you know, we're living in an exciting time. So all kinds of things, unprecedented things. The festival takes place in both Camden and Rockland, Maine. They're about 15 miles away from each other. And Camden, which is further north, was actually disrupted. Power went out of that town and kind of knocked out a day's worth of programming, unfortunately.
Wow.
But Rockland was in good shape, even though their main venue is in basically a boat hangar that's on the water for repairing boats. And that's where they construct a temporary cinema. And so like, that was, everybody was convinced that was going to be absolutely knocked out. But even though there were high winds and felled trees, that theater survived.
Wow. Okay. The festival that will not be stopped.
Will not be stopped.
So one big overlap that makes it a nice inclusion for here is their closing night film at Camden was also a film featured at Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Errol Morris's new movie, The Pigeon Tunnel.
Yes.
How should we get into The Pigeon Tunnel? Or perhaps we shouldn't get into The Pigeon Tunnel.
No, yes. We should not get into the metaphorical Pigeon Tunnel. But we should get into the film, The Pigeon
yes.
Tunnel. Of Errol Morris's films, it's his kind of one-on-one profile films with a notable figure. You know, I would say over the last 20-something years, fully half of his films fall into that category, if not more. But this one is a conversation with David Cornwell, who's also known as Jean Le Carré, and was conducted not long before his death in 2020. And it's I would say a lot about his early years, but sort of like goes beyond that, sort of working through the facts of his life, such as they are, as well as his fictionalizing of them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And it's funny because the capsule summary of it almost sounds very conventional. And in a way, it's more polished or more streamlined documentary I think he's made in a while, because there aren't these ruptures that come out of political sources, I guess is one way of putting it. They're not really like political flashpoints in the film that the movie is kind of structuring around or against. It's really just classic back and forth of a conversation and just two minds who are circling each other.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them in different ways, you know, extremely eloquent, and also just the differences in the rhythms of that, you know, Le Carré speaking in these like perfectly composed paragraphs and Morris with his, you know, pointed questions, at least the ones he lets us hear. That's one thing that's always funny to me. It's like, obviously he's selecting what of his audio will be heard. I have to just say, on one level, this was just such a joy to watch.
I agree. I found it like a great joy as well. The thing is, I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was strong filmmaking, and I found it joyful to watch, as we're saying. So part of me wants to leave it there, but you can't, because it's Errol Morris. Say that without sort of, I have to contrast that with other films I've felt where I haven't felt that in recent time, which I feel like I don't want to bog it down with that. But I do think that the fact that it is not a political figure that I have strong opinions of, and I'm therefore have strong opinions about the way that Errol Morris is handling or interviewing that person, the fact that that's not a factor in this one allows me to just sort of be with his way of making films and be with his interview style. And I could just enjoy it more. Yeah. There's no great revelation here. There's no third act reveal about the things that he's going to sort of talk about that that he's never said before, or, you know, that's not really what it is. And I'm really okay with that, because I also feel like that's not, in some ways, like the most frustrated I was with Errol Morris's interview is when he seems to insist on there being, there's some dark secret here. And, you know, and Cornwell's sort of like, I don't know what else you want from me. I've been telling you everything.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cute, and that he allows it to be there, but it's just sort of like, yeah, just let the guy talk and keep guiding him to different places. Like the time for the penetrating, challenging question was for, you know, several other subjects that could have used more challenging questions. This one is, he's doing just fine.
Yeah. And also, I mean, maybe some listeners were more familiar than I was with John le Carré's or David Cornwell's biography. I mean, he was the son of a confidence man, is sort of basically one huge way that the movie develops, and just how the kind of tendrils of that upbringing, or in some ways, you know, lack of a conventional upbringing, affected him, and how he came into his own, but also that involved a certain amount of like role playing, especially since he was sent to these schools where the purpose, as far as he could tell, was to make him like fit in an undercover way, almost from one class to the next, and the kind of like rigid British classism. So all these threads that get spun out and unwound, and I think he really brings to bear, le Carré does, just his ability to spin that web. And I think what you're saying, you know, it's true. I had that, and then it's a feeling of what Morris had done before. And I guess the feature article like framing of this would be like Morris coming back into his own after a period of just like this, it's like the motor. I'm just imagining this motor that like started up in an interesting way with, let's say, the fog of war or something, and then just kept on churning more and more through all the various political outrages of the past 20 years to the point where it just, you could just say, overheated, which happens to work because there's all this flame imagery in the Steve Bannon documentary.
Yeah.
And with like the respite of Elsa Dorfman along the way.
Yes.
But, and then finally here, there's just almost a palpable sense of returning to like artistic freedom and like blooming again. I mean, not to get like sentimental about it, but just like, I just felt that like it's almost like a burden lifted when he's able, you know, to do this. And like, you, as he said, not the feeling of having to make some grand revelation of the cut and thrust of, you know, whatever, putting people on implicit like trial or like, you know, all of this, which is just ended up being like this tango to madness because it's never going to be satisfying.
Exactly. And his fascination with people who are spin doctors,
yes,
right? His fascination with people who are basically well-trained in spin and in publicity, which is, that's fascinating, but it's very few people are up to the task to actually getting past that or getting beyond that spin. And I don't think he has been. So it's, in some ways, it's kind of interesting how he's like, oh, you must be spinning me. And Cornwell's like, no, I'm not. I don't give a shit anymore. I'm an old man. But to me, like, it does reveal what can be so valuable about somebody who's quite old, knows they're quite old, and just really wants to talk, you know, and is able to, has the recall to do so. I can't think of a circumstance where that's not interesting, you know, and not valuable. The fact that it's somebody who has this kind of tale to tell makes it all the more pleasurable. But just that attitude that he has of just like, what do I have to hide at this point? You know, and how he's just incredibly dispatches. He's like, yes, I have had women. I've been married. You know, I think I've finally landed at a good place. You know, there's really nothing to be said about it. Which I kind of like. I want whatever that is. I want verbatim for some point later in my life when I don't want to speak of such things ever again. but the other thing I was thinking as you were talking is like, there's a line here where when they're talking about interviewing and listening and trying to hear somebody else, and Cornwell basically says, aren't you really just interviewing yourself? You know, aren't you in a conversation with yourself? And sometimes we listen to the other person, but what we're getting is some answer that either affirms or does not affirm our sense of what things should be, you know? Mm. And I thought that was great. And it also made me remember like what my favorite films of Errol Morris is when I feel like he's talking to people that are some version of a mirror reflection of himself, that he identifies with these weirdos, you know? And this is not quite that because he's not that important in his life and that's not who Cornwell is, but the idea that he might be relating to this older man looking back at his art, you know, I think that brings out something really strong in his work.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. It's a good one. And I mean, actually, while we were talking, I did remember like one other interesting work that maybe kind of combines these different threads of like the political overheating, but also spinning out a tale. And it's the Wormwood Project,
right?
Which is such a curiosity, but just I just thought really, really kind of gets overlooked and is interesting. And it's almost like some spy tale in itself.
Yeah. And I think that the reenactment footage in this film were kind of akin, not akin, but I think that owe a debt to his work in Wormwood, where you know, his reenactments are less about the subjectivity of memory, but more about a kind of, you know, sort of, or not entirely just about that, but also just kind of a certain aesthetic that allows it to work a little bit more seamlessly with the archival and with the interview. I appreciated it here.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned the reenactment because it is a particular kind, and it's also distinct from some past Errol Morris use of not reenactment, but just scenes where it seems like he's purposely pushing like a cliche image or something.
Yeah.
Or an archetypal image. But here they genuinely feel like eloquent standing on their own scenes and images and metaphors. I always felt there was this implicit tongue in cheek about a lot of Errol Morris's use of things, you know, like the, I don't know, the whole like milkshake thing and Thin Blue Line, you know, like just the whole absurdity. And here there's definitely implicit absurdity to, I don't know, just the predicament of life. But it's not like that. I kind of liked how the images and these scenes had their own power, including the pigeon tunnel, which we won't give away.
I think it's successfully done. It's specific to something that Macare says, you know, and references. And I also think that it's not terrible as a metaphor for life. And it ends up being something that I think that it's hard not to see Errol Morris agreeing with or identifying with in terms of how he uses it. You know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, definitely. There are like a couple of details that Morris and or his like research team put together that are kind of illuminating about Le Carré's work as well. And especially the spy who came in from the cold. It's kind of amazing what he does there.
Yeah.
So the pigeon tunnel coming to a streamer near you, I guess, next month in October. I genuinely hope it's also showing in theaters. I mean, it has to be. I just don't know how it could be, but who knows?
I would imagine it is, but yes, I hope so.
Yeah, because it just also it looks great. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, for me, hugely anticipated and a relief. And another time anticipated film would be The Royal Hotel,
right?
From Kitty Green. This was a movie that, you know, immediately put me in mind of, as I started watching it, I immediately had flashbacks to when I had to watch Wake and Fright like three times for an article I was writing.
Oh yeah.
Cause it's partly in dialogue with that tradition, I think, mm-hmm. of going into the Australian outback, which is where it's set. And the filmmaker is also Australian. And it's two backpackers who, if I had it right, are on vacation, but they're also paying their way along the way, but then sort of run out of cash. So they take this job at a saloon, basically in a mining town in the middle of nowhere.
I think in terms of where they're at, I mean, they're more adventurous than I was, but I think they're in that post-grad area of being able to work abroad. So they're working in one spot and they decide that they want to, you know, get a job in another spot. And they take this, you know, ill-advised for two young women in a foreign country to be bussed into this remote mining town, which of course is populated entirely by men, which they even knew in advance. So, it, you know, nothing good can come of this whatsoever. And I think that nothing good does really come from it, but it's a, you know, I think very much from their point of view, it's not exactly a one location film, but a whole lot of the film happens at this bar, which is downstairs in this hotel. The Royal Hotel as a name is apparently an inside Australian joke. It's apparently the most common name for bars
and
establishments in Australia. I guess the theory is that at some point a member of the royal family visited, and once a member of the English royal family visit, then they would change the name of their establishment to the Royal Hotel.
That's great.
Which is pretty funny. Yeah. And the irony, of course, is this being just an absolute abject location to be called such a thing. And also the notion that a member of the royal family would ever visit this place is funny.
Maybe they would come to condemn the town or something like that.
Yeah. So it is a film that is very much kind of like you're saying, like there's a tradition it's working with here, but it's also kind of reveling in whatever expectations come from that and defying them, you know? And so I really appreciated it for that and enjoyed watching it work while also feeling emotionally invested in these two actors, Julia Garner and Jessica Henwick. Julia Garner, this is the second film in a row that she's worked with Kitty Green. She was on The Assistant. I enjoyed watching it and I was invested in them, even as I was kind of like watching, you know, Kitty Green and her co-screenwriter kind of play with me, you know? So I got a lot of satisfaction out of that. I also, I'm aware that, I don't know if this is where you stand or not, Nick, that sort of experience isn't going to work for everybody, you know? And even the notion of quote unquote working is sort of interesting, because I think my read of it is that it's not trying to work in ways we want it to work, but that doesn't mean that not to get bogged down in this one word, but that doesn't mean that for you or for anybody else, it works.
I think for me, I was intrigued by the premise and by the two actors who I think were clearly going to do something different with their roles. I mean, and what you might expect them to do. But I did have a sort of bumpy road with the movie, because I think it just sort of came down to not really understanding the choices by the characters. Beyond what the filmmaker was doing, I don't want to say it as like a diss or something, but it just went on and on, and it felt like it was painting itself into a corner, because the characters were making choices that just didn't add up to me. And even beyond, in the sense of like a horror movie, like don't go in there or don't do that, although there was a fair amount of that. I just didn't get it, you know. And at a certain point, the surprises that would feel like signs of like a real genuine human unpredictability, it wasn't functioning in that way. It just didn't make sense for the characters, you know. If I start specifying, it starts to sound like I'm judging their choices, so it's very tricky, because I think the movie is also challenging you, you know, not to do that.
Sure.
So, but it did just keep happening where I was like, I don't get that. Like even knowing what little we know about them at this point, I don't know why they're whatever staying there or not considering that or not considering that, but, or like, you know, canny about this, but not canny about that. And again, as soon as I say it, it's like, well, that's how people are. You recognize some things, you don't recognize others, but yeah.
I totally see that. And like, I was seeing that as I was having a different experience. So I totally get that. It shows you how difficult it actually is what she's trying to do and how worthwhile it is, but it doesn't, again, like that makes it even harder. Like the challenges, the stakes are even higher. Like if you're going to try to work within or sort of work parallel to the expectations of genre while also defy that genre and ideally represent actual behavior and plausible actions, it's hard to keep all those things in play, you know?
Yeah.
Because what you're describing in terms of like the horror film, like don't go in, why would you ever go in there? Like those are filled with people who would, like, it doesn't make any sense that somebody would make that decision, right? So if that's the case, is it forgivable that there are moments here where like, why would they make that decision? Or do we need to kind of like actually have a better sense of that? Does it need to be more plausible because it's not entirely working within that genre? I don't know the answer to any of these questions, but it does make it like the challenges are significant to kind of make it cohere within the work itself.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost as if the movie, I mean, even though I wasn't especially enjoying it, it's almost as if the movie could have been longer to kind of develop these varied paths and unexpected things, because as it was, it just felt like suddenly a lot of things had to be wrapped up and suddenly, you know, decisive actions had to be taken. And at that point, I'm just I the it didn't feel real anymore. It felt like it was fitting in the package of what it is, yeah. which is a 93-minute movie. Where anyway, I don't have to like dwell on that, but I should say that you know it's really interesting setting. They get this kind of grotty bar atmosphere, good, and especially like the upstairs where they're supposed to live is just like run down in exactly this accurate way.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of regret now that I even mentioned Wake and Fright, because then it sounds like, oh, well, if that's what you were looking for, then of course you expected all
the
break loose. But that was more just because like that was like a traumatizing movie for me to see.
But also, there's no doubt that Wake and Fright is sort of in the conversation with what the filmmakers are doing, you know? So that's there's no doubt about that. I mean, I will say that like it is a remarkable collection of how horrific straight men can be, like every sort of aspect of what, how a man could be selfish, manipulative, petulant, threatening, violent. Like it's all in there. So it's definitely sort of a survey of that as well. And I think a pretty damning one. I guess I should also mention the couple fun cameos in there.
Oh yeah.
Herbert Nordrum from Worst Person in the World shows up for a couple fun scenes. And Hugo Weaving, sort of unrecognizable Hugo Weaving, is a featured player here as well as the.
Oh man, yeah, I didn't even click with that. Oh wow, okay.
You can click with that?
No, I don't. What? Wait.
Hugo Weaving is the guy who owns the bar. As I said, an unrecognizable Hugo Weaving plays the sort of drunk owner of the bar, which you know he's a pathetic spectacle of a man, but also the sort of potential patriarch of the situation that could keep things in line, but is out to lunch.
Yeah, definitely. And the filmmaker Kitty Green, of course, she has made nonfiction as well. I don't know how much that came to mind, or if you just want to mention a couple of titles.
Yeah, so Kitty, this is her second full narrative film after The Assistant, and before that she worked in documentary, Casting of Jean Benet being the most notable one, mm-hmm. which had a significant release through Netflix. And yeah, I don't know that there's a real huge thread in terms of nonfiction work with this film. You know, I think in some ways The Assistant was a heavily reported script, and I think this is kind of like her departing a little bit further away from that. You know, I mean, I think that regardless of what you or anybody else thinks of this film, I think that she's kind of carving out a pretty interesting arc for herself and working in a different genre, a different type of film here. And yet I think it is still in conversation with something like The Assistant in Casting John Benet in terms of what's projected onto women.
Yeah. Actually, I wonder maybe if we could talk briefly about another movie just sort of on that topic, I guess, just also because it's kind of a, you know, high profile actor, director, Gonzo Girl.
Yeah.
So it's based on, I guess, a semi-autobiographical novel by Cheryl Della Pietra about being Hunter S. Thompson's personal assistant. And this is in the 90s.
Yeah, early 90s.
Early 90s. But it's like in a time warp of like permanent 60s almost, or permanent 60s into 70s kind of debauchery and writerly slovenliness, the Hunter lifestyle, the Hunter S. Thompson lifestyle. So yeah, it's just following that. It's directed by Patricia Arquette, which I think it's her feature film directorial debut. I suspect she's directed a bunch for television. And Willem Dafoe plays Hunter S. Thompson.
Well, not Hunter S. Thompson, but the fictional character.
Sorry, of course, good point.
Walker Reed.
It's kind of funny because staying to the end of the credits, there was some line about, it was like, I forget what Hunter S. Thompson's like partner was called. It was like, thanks to so-and-so for being a good sport about the final scene. And I didn't know what that meant. Anyway, so, but yes, definitely not Hunter S. Thompson, nothing to do with Hunter S. Thompson, just happens to wear the like bucket hat and glasses and do mountains of coke and maybe even name checks new journalism at some point. I don't even remember exactly.
Well, there's he's told by his longtime agent that what everybody wants is a Tom Wolfe, and he's like, fuck Tom Wolfe.
Right.
So there's a little new journalism reference there. That's part of it, I think.
Well, what did you think of Gonzo Girl?
Oh, I mean, listen, the some of the elements of this film in the recent past have not added up to much. I'm trying to think of why I'm saying that, but you know, the kind of like portraits of writers, films and the multiple Hunter S. Thompson films. You know, they're pretty scattershot group at best, as well as the coming of age story for a female protagonist in relation to, you know, charismatic older artist. Yeah, it's not the strongest track record. And so I didn't necessarily expect this to be great, and it's not, but it's maybe better than I expected is what I'm trying to build up to. And certain things are fun about it and interesting about it. I guess I'll start with things that are not interesting about it, which is I could probably go the rest of my life without seeing another representation of psychedelic drugs having an effect on people. There's just no new, different, accurate, whatever way of doing it. And it's just, you know, it's coming, and then it comes and it exults in it. And in terms of what the runtime could be dedicated to, the fact that there are long sequences like that is to me a waste. Cause I know this, I know that crazy image. I just know that there's going to be something like that.
Right.
And it's just not interesting to me anymore. And I haven't seen a successful version of that. Maybe Worst Person in the World a couple years ago, like, did sort of something different with that.
Oh, right.
But even that is not my favorite part of the film. There's interesting stuff here. And I think that Willem Dafoe actually goes for it. I think it's actually a really good performance. But the film is kind of really falls apart without him. And I think he kind of knows that and brings it to some degree. The fact that he's bringing it to, you know, a kind of fictionalized version of a person who made a fiction of himself, who we all kind of know a lot about, doesn't leave a ton of room for something new and interesting, but he's great to watch.
Yeah, he does go for it. And it's in a way a different kind of role for him. It's sort of like this kind of exhibitionist kind of role, but in a different way than he would have a role like that. I mean, it's strange to have seen like a movie, Inside. Did you happen to see Inside from earlier this year?
I didn't.
Where he plays this thief who basically gets left behind and locked in a penthouse. So it's kind of a strange, almost J.G. Ballard situation where he's trying to survive in this hyper luxury apartment. I guess here's what was interesting about the movie for me was the basic idea of a, you know, young creative woman in a situation where she's not really being valued, but is trying to find her own voice, and just what that says also about this kind of, you know, mythology of this crazy guy writer where we put up with all his weirdness and everything because of the genius, you know, this, and just the idea that a voice gets lost necessarily. It's almost like another voice is necessarily canceled out in the expression of that, you know, crazy genius voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, again, not the newest idea in other setups, you know, with traditional like artists, like painters or whatever. But in this case, it felt a little different, also because of the way the plot develops.
Right. Either she does, or she likes to think that she's ghostwriting.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. At the same time, you know, it's a tough balancing act, because giving full vent to the whole definitely not Hunter S. Thompson persona, it kind of takes up all the oxygen in the room. Yeah. But they did cast someone, Camilla Moroni, who, I mean, kind of is able to hold your attention and
certainly
play that kind of underdog, has to kind of fight for her own place. And Arquette herself is in it in a kind of interesting role, because she plays manager and enabler, really, and procurer in many senses, which is, I thought, was kind of bold that she self-casts herself, you know, as a different, not that she's identifying with, but it's just kind of interesting to recognize that this kind of turnover of, like, you know, at one point you're trying to fight for your own voice, and then at a certain point you're part of the structure.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that was kind of interesting.
And also, I think a different, I think it alludes to different times and what's available to women in this orbit, you know,
right,
that she has to be absorbed in it, whereas our protagonist is going to sort of crash and burn and get out of there, you know, and maybe has more of a future.
Yeah.
And then somebody 20, 30 years
before them. So as strange as it might sound to describe it this way, it's almost a partly about the realities of living with definitely not Hunter S. Thompson. and what that means. Like, in a sense, it's like it's akin to movies that were coming out in the 90s too, or even the 80s, of like the wages of the 60s or something. So yeah, that's Gonzo Girl. You know, I'm sure that's going to be coming out, if it's not already acquired, I think.
I don't think it has been. I mean, it's a weird time for this. 10 years ago, this would be snatched up and somebody would do something interesting with it. But yeah, these days it's a little bit bleak.
Yeah, it's true.
I was thinking about this film the last few days. You know, I saw this film a week or so ago, and what's blown up in Jan Wenner's face, you know, the founder of Rolling Stone.
Oh, wow.
Who, you know, published a book of interviews with great spokespeople of rock music, and did an interview with the New York Times that he was challenged about why they're all white men. And his answer was something about, I mean, even worse than what I'm about to paraphrase, about, you know, well, the women and the people of color were not really as articulate as the men in his book. And I think about that. I was thinking about Gonzo Girl and, you know, Hunter S. Thompson being, you know, one of the great stars of Rolling Stone. And, you know, his sort of legend was sort of fostered by Rolling Stone. And, you know, this is being a publication that I revered and grew up reading. And so many of those writers became my first wave of kind of heroes when I wanted to have a writer with my own voice. And to kind of reckon with that a little bit, which doesn't undo what is meaningful to me, doesn't undo what contributions, say, Rolling Stone has made to culture and writing. But a far darker film could be made than Gonzo Girl, and that's okay. Gonzo Girl is what it is, and it is dark in its own way. But certainly that kind of reckoning with that generation of kind of self-mythologized male artists is something that either we need to continue to do, or maybe we're beyond it because we all know at this point, you know, how toxic and empty it is. But it's just an interesting moment to be kind of that relationship with that generation is sort of still playing out in real time right now.
Completely. I'm so glad you brought that up.
And in some ways, my favorite part of Gonzo Girl is when it's actually the two older characters, when it's the Willem Dafoe and Patricia Arquette character kind of cuddling as family members during a down moment, that felt the most true. You know, like, what does that look like? You know, forget about what we all know about what this behavior is like, but what is it like to kind of know, to be living in kind of the wake of the mythologized life you've created? Like, what are the down times like, are more interesting to me than a lot of what gets played out.
Right. So that is Gonzo Girl, directed by Patricia Arquette. Maybe, is there a movie that might be new to people? I think you mentioned a couple that I was really curious about.
So another film that I saw at the festival called The Peasants by DK and Hugh Welchman. So the same team made a previous film called Loving Vincent in a similar style. It is an incredibly painstaking approach where every frame of the film is an oil painting. And they use software to sort of blend one painting into the next, but each frame is indeed a standalone painting.
Just to clarify, because when I read that, I thought it was entirely, that was the starting point for the image, was the painting.
Exactly. It's not.
Yeah.
Right. So the starting point is basically a fully recorded film with actors. And then each of those frames is rendered into a painting by hand, by an artist, and not by one artist, by many, many artists, because in the introduction to the film that I saw, they said that if one person did those paintings, it would take them 100 years to do. Gee. So,
also they would have, I mean, I'm sure would have carpal tunnel syndrome or something like that.
Beyond carpal tunnel, or whatever Michelangelo suffered by painting the Sistine Chapel on his back, or whatever that meant. Yeah, and it's an extraordinary process. It's unlike anything else to look at, surely. And I do appreciate that there are different artists doing it, because from scene to scene, you know, it's kind of amazing how much continuity there is when it's obvious that different hands are at work from one scene to the next. So it feels quite alive in a way that most films these days don't, or are not allowed to be, by being kind of conceived on a frame-to-frame basis. What stunned me is that I think this film really works as a narrative film, and actually has really fantastic performances in it. And that winds up being like the stronger takeaway for me, not that the what's being achieved visually isn't significant, but for me, the that doesn't last for however long this film is, nearly 2 hours. That would be way too much time if there was not a compelling narrative, but the narrative really works for me. And it's an adaptation of a book, and it's sort of 19th century agrarian setting with, you know, the time of arranged marriages where there's this one incredibly beautiful woman who is the object of everybody's fascination and desire. And then she winds up becoming commodified and over time being the object of blame for what things that go wrong in their town. Plot wise, it's a little somewhat resembling of Dogville.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, in terms of its arc and what happens to that one character. But that's not a film that I personally love very much, partly because it's so allegorical. And, you know, obviously it's the whole point of it is that it's contrived. But to me, it's to the point of not having living, breathing characters, whereas The Peasants really does, even though we're looking at oil paintings, not living, breathing people. So, yeah, and there's a very strong cast of great Polish actors that are the voice and the foundation of what we see. Yeah, I don't know. I was really taken by The Peasants. I think it's a very, very, very strong film. And we were just talking about, you know, another era, somebody would be picking up Gonzo Girl and running with it. This is, to me, a home run if you are looking to push a one-of-a-kind work of animation. And if you're going to think about it in terms of what you can make out of it and the attention you can get for potential awards consideration. And I believe the Vincent Van Gogh film was nominated for an Oscar. So like they certainly have that track record. But I just think this is a much stronger film and I think is pretty devastating feminist storytelling.
That's fascinating. I was only able to watch the beginning of it. Although I could see that things might not go great, I didn't see how exactly it played out.
You don't really see, I mean, it goes very wrong, but it's not necessarily obviously building to that.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad to hear about that one. The Peasants, and that's, which section is that one in? Not that it matters.
I think those are special presentations.
Special presentations, okay. The sections are perennially a little confusing to me.
Especially that since what used to be contemporary world fiction is now called centerpiece, which is fine because I feel like contemporary world cinema maybe somehow was unappealing to people who don't want to see just world cinema. I don't know what kind of person that is, but maybe that's the case. But right. Centerpiece doesn't necessarily describe much.
Right, right. Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, with whatever it is, I guess over 150 or 200 films or however many.
Yeah.
But I'm glad we were able to give a centerpiece spotlight for the Peasants.
Before we move on, one thing just in terms of that categorization, how that kind of matters and doesn't matter, we won't go into it, but another film that I really liked called Working Class Goes to Hell was in the Midnight section. And I'm so glad that it's programmed and I kind of love it in the idea of a midnight section. I get why it's there. It's sort of playing with the horror genre and the kind of the occult theme of the film, but it's certainly not the sort of film that the people who are going to see B movie out and out horror movies are going to necessarily appreciate, you know, but that's where it can be. And so I'm so glad that it's there. I think there used to be something called Vanguard or something like that, that maybe it would have wound up in that spot. And so where you put films, how much do the categories determine what you program and how much do you program and then simply find a category for it? When you have a festival that size, that's always a challenge.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, this is, sometimes the framing means something for an audience member, but sometimes like there's only so much we should make of those frames.
True.
You know, because ideally programmers are going well beyond whatever those buckets are.
Yeah. So we have two more films to talk about, which I wanted to make sure that we get to. American Fiction is directed by Cord Jefferson, stars Jeffrey Wright. It's based on a novel from, I want to say 2002, 2003. And it's about a novelist, a Black novelist who is just completely fed up with the industry that he's in and also just the portrayal of African-Americans in culture, you know, movies, books. And this movie pretty boldly plays out the scenario, which is a bit like him doing an I'll show them kind of reducto ad absurdum move where he writes exactly the sort of book that he feels panders to, you know, white guilt and pieties and people saying the right things without actually following through on them. And it's, you know, this is a very, this is part of a very complex like dialogue and tradition, not just in fiction, you don't need me to say, but also, you know, in essays. So just briefly, this is a movie that people have praised Wright's performance, rightly so, because he has to kind of walk this path of this curmudgeonly character who's taking these kind of bold steps, and what is often a kind of cluster bomb style of criticism where no one's really safe. He has a family of his own that his mother is ill and his sister, you know, they're kind of working out how to take care of their mother. So there are all these other things going on that give it a kind of more rounded portrait of how he's moving through the world. But it's very still firmly in like a satirical tradition. And it's a movie that I kept on sort of moving back and forth on. I mean, it's funny. I almost couldn't believe that in 2023, there were some of the things that are in it, just because I think that there may be different sensitivities now than maybe in the early 2000s. You know, obviously a touchstone for it is Bamboozled, which came out just couple years, I think, before the book did. It's kind of interesting to think about, well, the book, how much it might have been a reply to that in some way. There's just a lot to unpack in this movie. It ended up, as predicted by Adam Neyman, it won the Audience Award at TIFF ahead of The Boy and the Heron, which I thought was pretty cool at that. Won an audience award. I think it's the next in the holdovers.
Is that right?
I forget. So American Fiction, yeah, just a pretty bold debut that's I admired for trying on a lot of fronts. So trying to somehow make a really fully fleshed out and felt satire, not pulling any punches. I almost want to wait till this one comes out so we can talk about it more at length. It was kind of a late viewing for me, but I just wanted to kind of definitely include that.
Of course.
But on to a movie that we have both seen, and that is The Holdovers.
Yes.
An Alexander Payne joint.
Yep. Briefly, I mean, The Holdovers is the latest Alexander Payne film, so many of which I've actually seen in Toronto. They do tend to show up there. And so I have these significant experiences watching his films in that setting. And this is a story of set in the early 70s, I think 71, 72, of boys in a boarding school who are held over during the Christmas season because there's no home to go home to, or the circumstances aren't right for a home visit. And so a crusty, cynical professor played by Paul Giamatti is required. He's the one who has to stay. He's also held over to take care of them and sort of occupy them during the 2 week break. And there's one young man among them who's probably the most rebellious, probably the smartest. And he and Paul Giamatti are also going through their own self-reckoning. And then there's a third character played by the manager of the food service who's also around to cook, but then also is going through her own isolated experience because she's lost her son to combat in Vietnam War. And it becomes kind of like a film about these three characters over the course of that time. It is extremely Alexander Payne film in every possible way. And I was glad for that.
It was maybe even like a... if there was an edge to Alexander Payne, he took that off for this as well. I mean,
it's like Alexander Payne clearly like is a product of like early 70s heyday American independent cinema. And this is like him making an actual early 70s American independent film down to like the font treatment and the graininess to it and the beats and the form of it, the way that the montages and music's worked. It is just simply making one of those films.
I would agree that that's what that's this in the spirit of that and the Cat Stevens songs. And I mean, there's a bagginess that you can't replicate really of those 70s films and also just, I mean, more of a, I don't know, sense of risk than you could possibly have. I mean, this was somewhat easy listening. I have to say to a certain extent, I only say that in the sense that there is a ceiling or a floor, I sometimes think of it as, to what's going to happen in terms of like the dramatic import or anything. But one thing I would say that was a bit different from other Payne movies is that I thought there was a less of a satirical element, speaking of satire, which I actually came to realize while watching this is something that I sort of need as an ingredient in his films, maybe exactly because of, the other aspects of it that are a bit, So
Fair.
That's something that's not entirely in here. I mean, it's so the kind of culture, whatever culture or counterculture conflict is also like, it's just so baked into it that it doesn't really need or try to develop it, you know, it's just there. So, so there's a certain dynamism that's missing there. I mean, that said, you know, nobody does Cranky, you know, as well as, Paul Giamatti, who, of course broke out with basically more or less with Sideways, another Payne film.
Well, he's sort of like somehow that the dialogue that Payne, and in this case, the screenwriter that he worked with, it makes sense with him as the vessel, you know, that he just really knows his way around those words.
Yeah.
I liked it more than you did, you know, to be a little Siskel to your Ebert, whatever. there's not the steerical edge. It's maybe it's light FM. Maybe I'm at the age where I can also enjoy light FM. but, you know, there's just, he's always been a classicist. You know, it's one of the things we've credited for from the beginning. And I just get a ton of pleasure out of seeing how well he can make a scene and how well he can dramatize and shoot a scene, like the meat and potatoes thing that is just not to be overlooked. And the way that he kind of does this sort of montage sequence in there that is very much of a 1971 montage sequence. And it just plays like gangbusters. Like, I just think this is how it's done. And so, like, there's something about the way the sort of simple but effective storytelling that I really appreciated. It wasn't a minor thing for me that he was doing that. The only edge I would say that I would submit is that, and this is not the first time that this is entered Alexander Payne film, but I do think in terms of where it's approaching class and how it's approaching class is perceptive and specific and not easy to do because he's not making a socialist film. He's not coming from necessarily a working class place all the time, but from that kind of like a specific middle class space of this and being able to both kind of, you know, bite up and also acknowledge what's below. That is not the most radical thing to do, but it's also not easy to navigate. And I think he does it pretty well.
I agree with that. Yeah, there he is getting a specificity there. But...
Well, that certainly will make its way out there, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's actually opening. It has an opening date. I don't know if it's next month. And yeah, you couldn't get a more like fall winter movie. It's
oh my goodness,
steeped in that.
No, it's a for those who really, really care about this such things, and there are a lot of them. This is a Christmas movie. There's a new Christmas movie that you can
that is true
program for your Christmas breaks going forward.
Indeed. So the holdovers, and I think we might bring it in for an ending there. There's, again, like, whatever, 150, 200 other movies, so it's always just a subsection, but I'm sure a number of them will be coming to later in the year. And on we go to New York Film Festival and beyond.
A lot of great films, exciting times. It's also just, it's a lot at once. You know, you were in Venice, there was Telluride, we were in Toronto, I was in Camden, New York Film Festival's coming. It's a dense time, but an exciting one.
Yes.
So we'll have a lot more films to talk about in the coming weeks.
Indeed.
Thanks, Nick.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.